In this episode, we hear argument before the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in United States v. LeBeau. The case presents a federal aggravated sexual abuse prosecution on tribal land and turns on whether the district court properly admitted testimony about an earlier, uncharged sexual assault under Rule 413 of the Federal Rules of Evidence. Rule 413 permits the government to introduce evidence of prior sexual offenses to show a defendant's propensity to commit such crimes, a significant exception to the usual bar on propensity evidence. The defendant, Adriano LeBeau, had been charged years earlier with aggravated sexual abuse arising from an incident involving a different alleged victim, but the government voluntarily dismissed that charge and never refiled it for more than 3 years. At trial on the current charges, the prosecution introduced testimony from the earlier alleged victim under Rule 413. LeBeau argues that the district court erred in admitting this testimony without a hearing on its reliability and in barring him from telling the jury that the prior case had been dismissed. The panel hears from Stephen Babcock for the appellant and Kelsey Sable for the United States.
Good morning, may I please the court?
Stephen Babcock now begins the argument for the appellant, Adriano LeBeau.
Counsel, my name is Stephen Babcock. I represent the appellant in this case, Adriano LeBeau. This is a long saga. In 2020, Mr. LeBeau was charged with two counts of aggravated sexual abuse when he was a juvenile. Ultimately, the district court in that case dismisses one of those counts based upon a Brady violation by the government.
A Brady violation occurs when the prosecution fails to disclose material evidence favorable to the accused. The name comes from a Supreme Court case requiring prosecutors to turn over exculpatory evidence in their possession. A violation can lead to dismissal of charges or reversal of a conviction if the withheld evidence was material to guilt or punishment. Here, the district court dismissed one of the earlier charges against LeBeau after finding that the government had committed a Brady violation.
Then on the heels of that, the government voluntarily dismisses the other count and doesn't recharge that count for well over 3 years. In the subsequent federal prosecution in this instant case, the government files a 413 notice to use both of those two previously dismissed counts as 413 propensity evidence.
Rule 413 of the Federal Rules of Evidence allows prosecutors in sexual assault cases to introduce evidence of a defendant's other sexual offenses. Normally, evidence that a person committed other crimes cannot be used to suggest the person has a propensity to commit crime, but Congress carved out an exception for sex offense cases. Under 413, evidence of prior sexual assaults is admissible to show the defendant's disposition or propensity. The rule still requires the court to weigh whether the probative value is substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice.
We file a motion in limine, essentially, to exclude that evidence. The government then files a response to that backing off of the count in which they were held to violate Brady, but proceeds on the count that they voluntarily dismissed and didn't recharge for an additional 3 years.
Counsel, the rule does not require, does it, that a past act have resulted in a criminal charge, let alone a conviction, right?
Correct. It does not, but the rule does require an analyzation of Rule 104B that what is being presented.
Federal Rule of Evidence 104B governs conditional relevance. When the relevance of evidence depends on whether a particular fact exists, the court does not itself decide that preliminary fact. Instead, the judge admits the evidence if there is sufficient proof that a reasonable jury could find the fact by a preponderance of the evidence. The jury then decides whether the fact exists and how much weight to give the evidence. In this case, the question is whether there is enough evidence for a jury to find that the prior sexual assault occurred.
That it's relevant if the fact exists. And in our response to the government's notice, we included the government's own investigation where the witness in the 413 evidence, her sister, who was an eyewitness, stated as though that she was in the room.
Well, she wasn't an eyewitness, in fact. I mean, she was came into the room.
And as the evidence played out in the trial.
I'm sorry?
Excuse me. Well, I would argue as though that she definitely was an eyewitness.
Counselor, you probably should wait for the question to be finished.
I apologize profusely.
She was an eyewitness to the fact that the girl was there, that she was in the room, that LeBeau went into the room, and then she went into the room later, but she couldn't have known what happened during the period she wasn't in the room.
She was in the room by her own testimony and her own statements shortly after Mr. LeBeau entered into the room, which we
and she became extremely livid about him being there, and it was very difficult to see why she would be so livid if something wasn't going on.
Right. And she gave a statement to law enforcement that her sister was clothed, that Mr. LeBeau was clothed, and she kicked him out. And
that's what she said then, but that's not what she said at trial.
What she said in trial was that Mr. LeBeau was clothed, is that for the very first time, after multiple interviews and multiple years, now that Mr. LeBeau was on top of her. And the government's even backed off from that in their own briefing, because in all
that,
of the...
That was a subject that was could have been and was raised at trial, that the credibility question. I mean, that was available and used. So what I guess I have a great difficulty seeing what difference it would make to say in the face of these conflicts in testimony, what would it have even added to say there was no criminal charge brought?
I believe as though that the reason why that it matters on why there was no criminal charge brought was the government themselves on their own volition dismissed that. There was.
First of all, as the district court said, there are many reasons one could dismiss a criminal charge.
Correct.
So if so is your position that you would have been able to prove that the reason they dropped it was because they thought that there wasn't what? They couldn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, but that isn't the standard at this point, even then. So it's not very useful for that purpose. In other words, even if it were relevant, which I don't know that it is, that they thought they couldn't prove it then beyond a reasonable doubt. Now they don't have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
No, they do not have to prove it.
So how? And not only that, it's all the state of mind of the government, what the government thought of the evidence. Why is that pertinent at this point?
Oh, it's pertinent at this point because the statements that were made in the 413 testimony should have been gone through an analysis on whether or not they were reliable, but they weren't. And the district court itself did not rely upon the 413 evidence, even though the government argued it big time at the time of sentencing. So at sentencing, where you go into the whole world of relevant conduct and all sorts of matters come in, the district court specifically stated that it was not going to rely upon the 413 evidence when imposing sentence. However, without even going through a test of reliability, it was able to be heavily used by the government during the trial.
And it was heavily questioned. The credibility of it was questioned.
It was questioned, but it's highly prejudicial if unreliable evidence comes in of allegations of previous sexual abuse.
How would you make this reliability determination? We know from the case law that you don't have to have a hearing, right? You said you wanted to have a hearing, but the case law says definitively, Huddleston, you don't need to have a hearing. So if you don't need to have a hearing, how would you prove the reliability up when you have a witness who is testifying that this is what happened? You're going to make credibility determinations? What are you going to do?
Well, I think as though that is certainly something that should have been outside the purview of the jury. And Rule 104B states that a hearing should happen if justice entails. And that was
you
not
asked
done.
For one?
No.
You didn't ask for one, correct?
I did not ask for one, which would have didn't ask for one. But it also states as though that justice entails. And in this particular case, justice did so entail because there was a statement made by the sister, quote unquote, my sister wasn't raped. And this is not.
But the witness, the sister said she was raped. So therefore it's a question of who was truthful.
Well, the sister said that she believes that she was raped, that it was blurry, that it was foggy, that she couldn't really remember. And these are all the same things that the district court relied upon when not using that 413 evidence when imposing sentence on this case.
I want to go back to the relevance of the matter, because suppose the DA or the U.S. attorney or the relevant prosecutor had come in and said, well, I believed that I could easily prove this by a preponderance of the evidence, but I had doubt as to whether I could prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. That is quite likely what was going through someone's mind. So how is that relevant? How is it helpful?
If I can backtrack a little bit on how most of these 413 evidence claims come into play. And most of the time, and I've tried many of these aggravated assault cases, and the government will file the 413 notice, and you'll get police reports from 6 or 7 years ago. And there was no charges brought. There was no convictions brought. Nothing. So you're at least at the very able as a defense attorney to be able to cross-examine that agent during trial that this was reported years ago, correct? And no charges were brought, correct? We tried to even cross-examine the agent in this case, and the district court struck it down and said it wasn't relevant, which flies in the face of the district court's reasoning in going through the 413 analysis. The LeMay factors set forth by the Ninth Circuit.
The LeMay factors are a set of considerations from Ninth Circuit case law used to evaluate whether prior bad act evidence should be admitted under rules like 413 and 404B. These factors help the court weigh probative value against unfair prejudice and include the similarity of the prior act to the charged offense, the closeness in time, the frequency of the acts, the presence of intervening circumstances, and the necessity of the evidence beyond what was already presented at trial. The district court applied these factors when deciding to admit the Rule 413 testimony.
The intervening circumstance, the district court completely said that the fact that the case was moved for dismissal and it was dismissed was relevant. And then at trial, using the same rules of evidence, 104B, 413, 403, the district court said it wasn't relevant. And then the district court once again stated that they weren't going to rely upon that imposing sentence. And it was highly prejudicial in this particular case, and certainly not harmless, because the way that the government leaned into that evidence in closing argument, they said it was frosting evidence, it was bonus evidence, it broke the tie. Well, if there's a tie in a criminal case, the defense wins. The standard is beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, was the jury ever told that the defendant was arrested or charged for the prior act?
No, couldn't have been.
So you would have been introducing evidence that there was a charge and then dismissed.
Correct.
So in a sense, there, because the jury was never told that there was a charge, was there any need to say that it was dismissed?
Yeah, I believe as though that there was a need to say that it was dismissed because that was a move that was made voluntarily by the government.
But the jury never found out it was charged.
No, they did not find out that he was charged. Okay. However, at least the fact, as the Dowling case that was relied upon heavily by the government during the argument at trial, which they backed off on now, when they used acquitted conduct as 404B evidence. At the very least, in that case, the district court said multiple times that two times they said as though that he was acquitted of that conduct. And once again, as I'm stating,
in that case, there was evidence of a charge to begin with, correct?
There was evidence of a charge to be done with.
This is different.
Have done? Would you have put the agents on the stand and asked them why they dropped it?
I couldn't do that. The district court wouldn't allow me.
If he
had allowed the dismissal in, would you just leave that, the dismissal as it's, if you leave the dismissal without an explanation, It seems to me the relevance is extremely flimsy because there are all kinds of reasons that cases get dropped, right? In other words, it could have gotten dropped because they were too busy that day. We don't know.
Well, we know why.
Excuse me.
So
you would have to establish why it was dropped and for it to be permanent, wouldn't you?
No, I think there could have been a curative instruction like there was in the Dowling case, merely stating as though that he was acquitted of that charge. In this particular case, you could have said that the case was dismissed. And it wasn't a secret why the case was dismissed.
But the difference between an acquittal and a dismissal is that an acquittal is a determination of something determinative, i.e., this case, it wasn't proven to us beyond a reasonable doubt that he did this. A dismissal can be all kinds of things. So unless you establish that it has something to do with the nature of the evidence, and then you still have the preponderance reasonable doubt problem, you don't have anything. There's nothing relevant about it.
I believe that it's relevant because it can certainly be perceived as going to the credibility of the unreliable testimony.
You'd have to bring that out. Otherwise, it could have been that they were busy that day.
The district court knew the reason why the case was dismissed, and that was
because... That isn't the question. The question is, what would the trial have looked like?
The trial would have looked like at least we would have been able to stand up and combat that in closing argument and said that evidence that you're using is frosting evidence, that you're using is bonus evidence, that you're using to break the tie. That was originally a charge that the United States Attorney's Office had. They dismissed it, and for 3 years they never recharged it.
Unless you establish that they dismissed it for a reason related to the quality of the evidence.
The reason why that the district court stated that it was dismissed was, of course, the companion, the sister case with it, was dismissed because of Brady violations. And then right after that, they didn't want to charge this case. So there certainly should have at least been a determination of reliability. And I see that I've gone over my time. Thank you very much.
Kelsey Sable now begins the argument for the United States, the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Kelsey Sable from the District of Montana on behalf of the United States. The District Court did not abuse its discretion by admitting Jane Doe 1's testimony at trial and denying the motion to introduce evidence that the case charging the conduct against Jane Doe was dismissed. The District Court correctly, in following the United States Supreme Court case in Huddleston v. United States.
Huddleston v. United States is a Supreme Court case that established the standard for admitting evidence of prior bad acts. The court held that the trial judge does not need to make a preliminary finding that the defendant actually committed the prior act. Instead, the judge asks only whether there is sufficient evidence for a reasonable jury to conclude by a preponderance of the evidence that the act occurred. Credibility and weight are left to the jury. The government invokes Huddleston here to argue that the court properly let the jury decide whether the earlier assault took place.
Left the determination of Jane Doe 1's credibility and the fact-finding on the prior sexual assault to the jury. As the district court correctly noted in its order, the question for the court is whether there is evidence sufficient for the jury as the fact finder to determine that the sexual assault against Jane Doe 1 occurred by a preponderance of the evidence. The court does not itself weigh the evidence or weigh the witness's credibility or find that the government proved that conditional fact by a preponderance of the evidence before it admits the evidence at trial. And Jane Doe 1's memory was always that she woke up with Mr. LeBeau inside of her. She was consistent in that statement throughout her interviews with law enforcement and her testimony at trial. She only stated that she was not assaulted based on what her sister, AMB, told her, based on AMB's involvement that night. And Mr. LeBeau's argument to the district court for excluding that evidence was that AMB, you know, we must believe AMB, and AMB said this did not happen, and we must believe AMB, so we cannot believe Jane Doe 1. But AMB's statement was also consistent the entire time that she was not in the room the entire time, that he was in there before she was. She said to law enforcement that it was a minute or a couple of minutes, but she also said that she was drinking that night as well as Jane Doe 1. She insisted that she was not drunk, but her memory of that time that he was in the room without her is certainly susceptible, to impeachment or, could be inaccurate. I would also note that Jane Doe did not initially disclose the sexual assault. It was several months after the event that she disclosed, and it was several months after her disclosure that AMB was interviewed. So there was no reason for AMB to fix this event in her mind or make it notable, before all of this came out and before she was interviewed. And with respect to the evidence related to the charge against Jane Doe 1, the district court was correct in its order and in its discussion at the sidebar when this came up at trial that evidence that the charge of the conduct against Jane Doe 1, evidence that that was dismissed was irrelevant to whether Jane Doe 1 was credible or whether that sexual assault actually occurred. I mean, as this court has noted.
Did the judge also make a 403 ruling with regard to the Jane Doe evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court's order was incredibly thorough and went through all of the LeMay factors and analyzed each of those factors and determined that the evidence was not more prejudicial than probative. And the district court's analysis was thorough. It was detailed.
So we don't really have to decide that it was not probative at all.
No, Your Honor. I mean, I think the district court, this court has consistently affirmed that the district court has wide latitude to evaluate the admissibility of evidence and weigh the prejudice of evidence against the probative value. So
presumably we could assume that the evidence met the relevance threshold and simply, and from your perspective anyway, affirm on the ground that there was appropriate 403 balancing about confusion and so on and so forth.
Yes, Your Honor. And I apologize. I believe I misunderstood your question, Judge Berzon. But with respect to the evidence, my answer is the same. Yes, I think that's right. I would say that I think that the district court was correct that evidence was not probative at all. But I would agree that even if this court were to find that the evidence of the case dismissal had some limited probative value, this court could also find that the district court was correct in its analysis that the prejudice or the risk of confusion and misleading the jury outweighed that limited probative value.
And that it would have, somehow you would have had to try, you would have had a whole side trial on why it was dropped, because it would matter why it was dropped.
I think that's right, but I don't know that we...
And that's what the district court said, actually. So what do we do if we let it in? Do we then ask the agent why he dropped it, and how do we do that?
I think that's correct, Your Honor, but I don't know that we actually could have practically fully explored that or fleshed that out. I think Mr. LeBeau's argument is necessarily that this evidence is relevant because it shows, this dismissal shows that the government did not believe Jane Doe 1 or did not think that this sexual assault actually happened.
And one response to all that is it doesn't matter what the government thought. Right.
Absolutely correct. My response to that is it doesn't matter what the government thought under Huddleston. That determination is up to the jury. And my other response to that would be we could not rebut that argument or that inference without vouching for Jane Doe. I mean, the agent, I don't believe it would be appropriate for the agent to testify, no, I actually did believe her or the government believed her or we thought this actually did happen. I think that's vouching and it's inappropriate. So it leaves that implication, that inaccurate implication in front of the jury. And so I don't think that that's, I don't think there's a way to present that evidence, even if it does have some scant probative value, that doesn't mislead or confuse the jury. It's up to the jury to determine whether this assault happened and what weight, if any, you know, that bears on its decision with respect to the charged offenses.
Now, both of these witnesses, the prior contract witness and Jane Doe and the witness in the current case were extremely vague about what had actually happened. But, I mean, so in terms of the adequacy of the evidence for the conviction, I guess the ultimate answer is it's up to the jury, but the victim in this case, you know, just fell apart completely in cross-examinations and didn't know anything. Does that make any difference in terms of the substantial evidence inquiry?
Well, I don't know that I would necessarily agree with that respectfully, Judge Berzon. She was very intoxicated that night. Nobody's disputing that. So I think her memory was certainly blurry and fuzzy, but she was absolutely clear.
She was clear in her direct examination. She had apparently been well prepared. And then as soon as she was cross-examined, she said, I don't know. I don't remember anything. I don't remember anything.
She had some difficulties with her memory on some details of that night, you know, where she was, whether there was some dispute about whether she was in the car when they went down to the basement, whether she was in the house when she went down to the basement. There were some parts of that night she did not remember, but she was absolutely clear both on direct and on cross that she went down into the basement because she thought that the cops were coming or he said something about the cops and that she blacked out and that when she came to, she had a knife against her neck and he was inside of her raping her. She was absolutely consistent about that the entire time. And she was consistent about that, not only in her statements at trial, but in her prior consistent statements to numerous other witnesses that testified to those statements by her at trial. She made initial disclosures to her friend Ben, who testified at trial, and his testimony was, you know, consistent with her testimony that she called him the next morning, hysterical, crying, upset, and he took her to Indian Health Services for a rape kit. Her mom testified at trial, consistent with the victim's testimony that she called her mom and told her what happened. Her mom testified she was also hysterical and crying and reported that Mr. LeBeau had raped her with a knife. She made consistent disclosures to the SANE nurse, to the first Bureau of Indian Affairs officer that interviewed her at IHS, and to the FBI that ultimately interviewed her a couple of days later. There was, you know, also the SANE nurse who testified. She testified to the victim's demeanor during the SANE exam, which was, you know, arguably the jury could have determined consistent with somebody who'd experienced trauma. Agent Wall with the FBI testified similarly. The SANE nurse also testified, as well as Agent Wall, I believe, that they both observed bruising on her neck. That may well, the jury could have determined, been consistent with having a knife held against her neck during the assault. So there was some significant corroborative evidence here. You know, and this court has continually held that it will only reverse for insufficient evidence if no rational fact finder could have found the essential elements beyond a reasonable doubt. And in the government's view, there's more than sufficient evidence for that here, even if we discount the 413 evidence. Mm-hmm. And if the court has no further questions on these issues or the others that will rate that were raised, I'll cede the rest of my time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. I would respectfully disagree that the 413 evidence wasn't highly important in convicting Mr. LeBeau based upon the, I would say, is inconsistent, foggy memory from P.S., the victim in this case. I do not believe there is sufficient evidence for a conviction on this case without the 413 evidence, which we continue to state was unreliable and didn't go through the proper process that should have happened. But if you take a look at P.S., the victim in this case, the individuals that testified, not only did she completely fall apart on cross, she wouldn't answer anything. And then additionally, you had the people that were at the house that night that completely rebutted many of her statements about how she got into the house, about when she arrived at the house, about how she was interacting with Mr. LeBeau, about how she acted after this supposed violent rape when the owner of the home said that she saw right afterwards and she was laughing. And next thing you know, she was trying to sleep in the owner of the house's bed. At no time did she tell anybody at any point as though that, hey, you know, just a little bit ago, somebody had a knife against my throat and it was him. So by acknowledging that and knowing it was a close case, the 413 evidence was relied upon heavily by the government.
Counsel, we understand your argument. Do you have, I think your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Okay, last we have McCulloch versus Bisignano.
The argument raises questions about the balance between admitting probative evidence of prior sexual conduct and protecting defendants from unreliable or unfairly prejudicial testimony. The court must decide whether the district court abused its discretion in admitting the Rule 413 evidence and in excluding testimony that the prior charge had been dismissed. Because this is a court of appeals argument, the panel will issue a written opinion, typically within several months. Nothing in the questions from the bench necessarily predicts the outcome.